for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. The loss of the parity is always difficult, but it's particularly tough when it happens in childhood. Bereavement in childhood often leaves emotional scars that last for decades. Joining me in the studio to talk about how to make the grief journey more manageable, Lynn Hughes. She's Chief Executive Officer and founder of Comfort Zone Camp. Holly Wilcox of the Johns Hopkins University, and Mary Owen of the Wendt Center for Loss and Healing. We'll take your calls throughout the hour, 800-433-8850. We do invite you to join us by email as well, drshow@wamu.org. Put a message on Facebook or send us a tweet. Good morning to all of
you. Morning.
Good morning.
First of all, Lynn Hughes, tell me about this organization you founded that many people may not have heard of, Comfort Zone Camp, how it was established, why, and what it does.
Well, Comfort Zone Camp is a bereavement camp for children who've experienced the death of a close loved one, a mom or dad, brother or sister, primary caregiver. And we are 12 years old, and we've become the largest in the country, and we offer free camps at no cost to children. And it started really out of personal experience and the love of camp. My parents died when I was 9. My mom died when I was 9. And my father died 2.5 years later when I was 12, and there were no resources. And then all these many years later, there's no resources. And my husband and I met at a summer camp when we were in college. I joke, it sounds like a bad TV movie. We were camp counselors in the Poconos, but we love kids in summer camp. And combining our love of summer camp with the lack of resources and that grieving kids needed a voice and a place, we created Comfort Zone Camp.
When you say there were no resources, were there relatives?
Well, in my experience, there really weren't. Every now and then, somebody would kind of take an interest in me for a season in my life, maybe a school counselor or the tennis coach or somebody for it, or my best friend's mom. But really, you were encouraged to put on that happy face and go back to acting like it didn't happen to you because you realized how uncomfortable other people were when you brought it up. They'd look at the ground, they'd change the subject, and like, oh my gosh, that happens to kids. And you'd end up comforting them, going, I'm not going to fall apart right in front of you. It's okay. And your loss becomes about making them comfortable with it. So you get the message. People don't want to hear about it.
Did you have any time or, as you say, there were no resources, but did you have any time to process your grief?
For me, with my mom dying, my dad remarried the next year, and then my dad died the year after that, living with my stepmother that we barely knew for about 5 years, and then I lived with an aunt and uncle for 1 year, my senior year in high school. It really wasn't until I got away in college and that things kind of settled down that then I was kind of going back and wondering, you know, who was my mom? What was she like? Or wanting to know things about my father. And kind of it hit me more when I was at a calmer place when I was in college. So that became a tough time. But before that, it was just kind of survival and trying to look like everybody else on the outside and fit in with my peers.
Lynn Hughes, she's Chief Executive Officer and founder of Comfort Zone Camp. She's author of the book, You Are Not Alone, Teens Talk About Life After the Loss of a Parent. And turning to you now, as you talk about losing a parent, Holly Wilcox, what are these studies that have gone on?
Diane, that's a very good question. In terms of the research base on this topic, there are a lot of methodological limitations. Just to give you some examples, many of the studies conducted in this area have small sample sizes, so they're small studies without comparison groups and without long-term follow-up. Many of them are just 1 or 2 years after the young person was assessed. And what that The result is that there are contradictory findings in the area. I think the most robust finding is that for depression. That young people who lose a parent early on are at twofold increased risk for depression. That is the one finding that I see most in the literature.
Would you agree with Lynn Hughes that there are very few resources or outlets for young people to express grief and thereby it turns inward?
I think there is some evidence for that. Lynn is certainly more of an expert than I on this topic. But in terms of research, we've recently conducted a large study that's population-based that followed young people over the course of 30 years. And from that study, which was carried out in Sweden, we looked at a number of outcomes. Most of them were in the psychiatric area, mental health-oriented outcomes, such as suicide, hospitalization for psychiatric disorder, and violent criminal convictions. And you may be thinking they're sort of on the extreme end, so we're not covering the full range of outcomes that young people can experience. But our study does show evidence that there is long-term risk for the among young people who lose a parent to death, for the outcomes we studied.
Holly Wilcox of Johns Hopkins University. Do join us, 800-433-8850. Mary Owen, what about the resources that the Wendt Center offers for young people?
Well, we have a variety of possible services. We are mental health-based, and we offer individual therapy and also family therapy. We go to the home for some families to give crisis intervention. We have three different offices in the Washington, D.C. area. We also offer a three-day camp for children in the summer, which is also free. It's grant-funded. And to help children from ages 6 to 16 be able to process their grief.
But, of course, you're also dealing with adults who may still be trying to work through their experiences losing a parent.
And that is such a very good point. We find often because children are expected to get over a death quickly, get back to school, get back to life, get back to things, told, oh, your mother would want you to do well in school, or your father would be disappointed if you didn't keep playing on the soccer team. I mean, there's a lot of encouragement for children to not fully grieve. And so we do find that adults come to the Wendt Center and for the first time really to talk about the grief that they had when their parent died when they were 9 or when their parent died when they were 5 or 16.
Mary Owen, she's clinical director at the Wendt Center for Loss and Healing. Do join us, 800-433-8850. I wonder, Lynn Hughes, when did you finally have a chance to really grieve for your parents?
And I think I was grieving for them all along, but it just had to be secondary to just survival and being okay. But I really think it was after I got through with college, because I didn't have a home base to go back to. And so once I was able to graduate and get a job and support myself, then it was like a big exhale. And then I could kind of, so I would say I was in my mid-20s.
What hit you? Did it sort of happen all at once, or did you find yourself bringing up memories or the lack thereof? How did it happen?
What happened for me, it was something else triggered it, some other problem that I was having in my life. And the thing is, grief doesn't go anywhere. It sits on your shoulder, comes out sideways, backwards, whether you're not able to keep a job or you have headaches all the time or not able to connect with people intimately. So I was engaged and I was having a really hard time making a commitment. And, you know, I kind of realized that the only way I was ever going to get that unconditional love back was through, you know, through a relationship. So I became very intense and kind of through going through counseling at 26 years old, which was paid parenting for me. I realized that it wasn't just me making a decision about whether or not to get married. It went back to I really needed to go back and grieve the loss of my parents.
Interesting. Does that sound typical, Mary?
Yes, it does. I think that that's where so often adults realize that they're trying to have adult relationships or they're trying to be successful at work and they can't seem to find the motivation or they can't seem to find the reason for being invested in something, and especially in terms of relationships, the fear of abandonment, the fear of the relationship ending, the anger that a relationship might not be everything you want it to be, and it's not filling up an empty space.
That word, anger, is one I wonder about, Holly, how often that comes into people's conscious thinking regarding the loss of a parent.
In terms of anger, one of the outcomes that we studied was violent criminal convictions, and that sort of taps anger. And we did find that the young people who lost a parent were at increased risk for outcomes that were in the violent criminal conviction area.
Holly Wilcox, she's assistant professor in the Division of Child and Adolescent Psychiatry. She's at the Johns Hopkins School of Public Health. We'll take a short break. We'll be right back. And we're back talking about the loss of parents in childhood, how that feeling may get buried because there are no ways to talk about it, to express the feelings that lie beneath the surface, and how that carries on into adulthood, how it may affect adult relationships. And just before the break, we were talking about anger. And Lynn Hughes, you wanted to add to that.
Well, I did. Just that I think a lot of kids are angry and the emotions are closer to the surface, but I don't think that they always attribute it to the grief and loss. They're just shorter with people. And again, it's the grief coming out sideways. And because kids don't wear black and mourn 24/7, adults miss it. They're not identifying it as grief, but yet all of a sudden here's this angry kid who gets frustrated really easily or, you know, is really rough with his younger sister or short with his friends or, you know, so again, it happens often, but I don't think people are making the link that's what it goes back to.
And of course, not everyone who gets angry turns to criminal behavior, Mary.
That's right. It doesn't necessarily mean criminal behavior, but one of the things that does happen is that often children are brought into counseling because the parents want their behavior to be fixed. You know, they're acting out. They're talking back to the teacher. They're refusing to do homework, and they come in because they want their children's behavior to get better, and we have to look at the grief issues to really be able to sort that out.
Diane, can I add one more thing? We had last year in camps, we run camps in four different states, but I had two different kids in Virginia. One was from Baltimore area and one was from the Richmond area. They didn't know each other. One kid shared a story about that he got defensive about running in a track meet the day his dad died. They didn't call into the school. He didn't want them to know, the school to know that day that his dad had died from a long-term illness, but he felt his dad would want him to run in the track meet that night. So when he came back to school and he got questioned about it, he got very defensive and they put him in anger management. As he's sharing this, the child from Baltimore jumped in, "Oh my gosh, the same thing happened to me. I got put in anger management too when a teacher like questioned him about having a tough day at school and he said, 'I'm missing my dad,' and she said, 'Shouldn't you be over that by now?' And he got very defensive. They placed him in anger management. Fast forward a month later, I'm running a camp in New Jersey and a girl up there who had lost her mother several years earlier, same type of thing, got placed in anger management in a New Jersey school system when got defensive when asked about grieving her mom. So again, this, you know, there's just such a lack of education and awareness, and they see the anger, but they're not making the link that it's grief and that this is an ongoing journey.
Holly, do you agree it's lack of education on the part of professionals who need to better understand what's going on?
I think that is the case. Also, so primary care physicians are a group that are well situated to help identify young people who may be at risk for psychiatric conditions, mental health, difficulties with grieving. Also, the surviving parent is well situated to be in tune to different symptoms that the young person may be expressing.
Such as
depression, anxiety, irritability.
I think one of the things about that, though, is that so often the parent, him or herself, is also grieving. Mm-hmm. And we know from research that the first year of spousal loss is very disorganizing. And we also know from the research that so disorganizing that many times parents don't parent the same way as they usually parent within that first year.
What do you mean?
It means that they're not as attentive, or they're not as patient, or they're not as involved. They'll skip things, you know, a school program or something, whereas they used to go to everything. Mm. They just don't have the energy. They don't have the emotional resources themselves. And so it's difficult because lots of times the parent who would be the, you know, most attuned resource for the child sometimes becomes the less attuned, the less informed, you know, just because they're dealing with their own grief and all of the things that they have to be managing. And so I think that sometimes parents, not as a criticism of parents, it's just that's the situation. The whole family has needs, and it's difficult for parents sometimes to be able to address all of their children's needs.
I must say, it would seem to me that, Lynn, you must have felt like an orphan pretty quickly, and that you either had to grow up faster, more quickly, or that you would revert to childhood more intensely. For you, perhaps it was a combination of both?
For me, I realized that my childhood kind of ended in that moment, and I realized the two people who wanted me on this earth were no longer present. And that's a lonely thing, and you kind of realize if you lay on the ground crying that you're waiting for somebody to pick you up, and that just didn't happen.
Did you have siblings?
I did. I have three brothers.
Mm-hmm.
And we all kind of went to our own corners, you know, of the house and grieved by ourselves. Nobody talked about it, and we weren't encouraged to talk about it. So I think that I grew up really fast and was intuitive enough to, again, keep up the good grades, put on that happy face, put on that exterior that I was okay, to not draw too much attention to myself. And so, again, people never questioned or sat with me. And, you know, again, it wasn't until I was in my 20s and having troubles then that they're like, oh, wow, did this affect her?
What about if a parent dies in a violent way of either suicide or homicide? How does that affect the child, Mary?
I think one of the things that we know is that we have something called disenfranchised death or loss. It's some kind of shame. Sometimes it's connected with the loss, suicide especially, but also homicide here in this city. I mean, families struggling with, you know, with situations that maybe have criminal activity or something that makes the death look bad in some way. And so the child often isn't given permission to grieve or isn't even given permission to talk about the loss. And because there's shame involved or there's a feeling that secrets are kept. So it's very, very difficult because children don't know what to do with their own questions.
Man.
Well, it also adds a layer of complication to it, especially when there's somebody to blame or a situation to blame and it could have been avoided. And there's something called the coulda, shoulda, woulda. You know, and the kids and the parents both will beat them up. If only I had done this, or if I would have done this, or if I would have been better that day, or if I wouldn't have upset them, or if I wouldn't have wanted, you know, to go outside and play ball with them that day. So, you know, that they'll drive themselves crazy, beating themselves up, which it's a harder for them to start the healing process when they get stuck in the woulda, shoulda, couldas.
Yes, I think it's that guilt. That is so hard. Children believe that because I said, I'm really mad at you, Dad, and he dies of a heart attack days later, that it's somehow they're responsible.
What are we talking about when we discuss children? Are we talking about 5, 6, 7 year olds? Are we talking about young adults as old as 20? What are we talking about?
Just in terms of our work that we've done, we looked at young people who were 25 years old or younger.
Really?
Go ahead.
I was going to say that babies can grieve. And sometimes their grief is even harder because they have no words to explain to them what they're missing.
Yeah.
But they don't hear familiar voice. They don't feel a familiar touch. They don't have a familiar smell. And so they can grieve. And I would agree all the way up till 25. That is still a time when you're not expecting a parent to die.
Yeah, and that kids are going to grieve differently depending on their age and their developmental level. Younger kids don't understand the permanence of death, and they have a lot of magical thinking like, oh, I can go out in the garage and get a ladder and climb up to heaven and bring them back. You know, and then kids 9 to 12 understand a little bit the permanence, but they still kind of are hopeful that maybe they can come back. And then the teens, their relationship got interrupted. You know, usually there's a lot of butting heads, and there's a normal teenage relationship, and yet they're interrupted and they can't, you know, ever go back and make that relationship smooth and peaceful. It often doesn't have the last memory. And so it just depends. It impacts them greatly. And sometimes you're grieving for the memories that were yet to be made. And when you're a little bit older, you're grieving for the memories that actually were.
Exactly. Holly, what about support groups for kids? Are those effective?
Well, once again, I think the research base for support groups is quite limited. There was one randomized trial that was published a couple months ago by Erwin Sandler, looking at the impact of support groups on the grief process among young people, and with some very encouraging findings. I'm not saying that the support groups don't work by any means. I'm not saying that, and I admire the people in the bereavement community out there and the over 500 plus centers that work with grieving young people. But there isn't a strong evidence base.
Lynn.
I would say the key is to break their isolation. Most of them have never met any other grieving children, so they're walking around feeling like they're the only ones. So whether it's a support group setting or like a bereavement camp, that peer-to-peer interaction lets them know they're not alone. And somebody with a lot of credentials after their name, you know, that they might not feel as open with as they do when one kid says, you know, I'm worried about who's going to give me away when I get married. And another, you know, child says, me too, but I've created a plan. Maybe you can come up with a plan too. You know, or they're talking about bad dreams and another one says, don't worry, I used to have that too, but now it gets easier. That's the magic of this peer-to-peer interaction.
Mary.
And I think especially with adolescents, so many adolescents say, I go to school, I don't care about prom, I don't care about who's in and who's out right now. I mean, all of a sudden, in an adolescent's world, death is just so serious, and it's just so different than what most adolescents are concerned about on a day-to-day basis. And I think that that's where the group, where other adolescents can talk about something that's so serious, and they don't have to be superficial. And I think that that's where it's really, really healing.
And instead of a teacher referring a child to anger management, perhaps a teacher who knows that a death has occurred can help that child, perhaps relating to a counselor at the school or putting that child in touch with another child who may have gone through the same experience. You're listening to the Diane Rehm Show, and we're going to open the phones now. We have many callers, 800-433-8850. Here's a message from the DR Show website from Molly. She says, I'm 45 years old, lost my mother to cancer when I was 21. I wasn't a child when she passed away, but the pain and feeling of vulnerability I experience over her loss affects me just as strongly now as it did a year after her death. What can I do so that I don't feel the pain of her loss so strongly after so many years? Mary.
Well, I think that's one of the things that we know, the grief process, there are certain tasks that help, and one is just the acceptance of the reality of the death. But another one that so often gets unresolved or doesn't get completely finished at the time of the death is really experiencing and expressing all of the emotions. And that's where sometimes seeking some additional counseling with a grief specialist really, really helps. Because we do know that we really need to be able to feel the full range of emotions, and not just in an intellectual way, but to really feel them and share them with someone.
All right, to Durham, North Carolina. Good morning, Brian. You're on the air.
Hi, thank you, Diane. I love your show. I listen to it every day.
Thank you.
I guess I was going to make a quick statement and/comment. I guess I was 18 and I lost my mother. I guess I lost my mother. She committed suicide. And I actually was present when she did it. And I actually, like your guest, didn't think it affected me too much until I got to the later years of my life and actually got into a relationship. And the relationship went south, and it brought old emotions, I guess, of my mother and my father's divorce and her attempted suicide. And I guess I ended up being in a similar boat as her and repeated some of the similar things that she did as well and tried to do that as well. And I guess I ended up seeking psychological help and ended up getting counseling for it. But I ended up finding that was a really, 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 really hard road to get insurance company to actually pay for my counseling. I guess a lot of my insurance company originally didn't want to accept the charges. You know, they actually wanted a committal program of me to actually fund it. And it actually takes a lot of counseling sessions, and a lot of insurance companies don't want to pay for it. And
let's talk about insurance here, Mary.
Yes, that's one of the difficulties. Bereavement technically is not considered a mental health problem. It doesn't come under the DSM diagnostic manual. And so often what we have to look at is the underlying anxiety or the underlying depression, because insurances will cover that. But bereavement in itself is just considered a normal process and isn't considered a mental health
so issue. You'd have to claim depression or anxiety or something like that in order for mental health insurance to cover it.
That's right. Everything we offer is free, so we're lucky that we don't fall into that. So there are resources out there, but sometimes you really have to look for starting maybe with a local hospice or a therapist that you know to start connecting the dots to find out what resources are in your area and what might be offered at no cost. But you often have to really look far and wide to find resources for grieving kids or adults.
Lynn Hughes, she's Chief Executive Officer and founder of Comfort Zone Camp. She's author of the book, You Are Not Alone, Teens Talk About Life After the Loss of a Parent. Short break here, and after we come back, more of your questions, comments. Stay with us.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by Vicki and Roger Sant and Island Press, which offers solutions to environmental problems in print, in person, and online at islandpress.org. By the Melville Charitable Trust, supporting efforts to find and fight the causes of homelessness, on the web at melvilletrust.org. And by the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information at macfound.org. This is NPR.
Linda Greenlaw is the nation's only female swordfish boat captain. She commands a salty crew battling storms and sharks to catch fish weighing hundreds of pounds each. How does she do it?
Well, most guys, especially fishermen, have respect for someone who works hard. The bottom line is, can I make them a paycheck?
Linda Greenlaw on the next Fresh Air. Join us.
And joining us now is Jeffrey Zaslow. He writes the Moving On column in the Wall Street Journal. He co-authored the book The Last Lecture with Randy Pausch. Good morning to you, Jeff. Thanks for joining us.
Hi, Diane. Thank you for doing this show. I know it's meaningful to a lot of people.
Well, I think so, too, Jeff. Tell me what drew you to this story in the first place.
Well, I'd heard about this comfort zone survey that they had done, and I was intrigued by it. I mean, especially having worked with Randy on the last lecture, I mean, I watched a man prepare his family for life without him. And so I've always been intrigued by the subject.
Tell me what kind of response you've had to the article.
Oh, it's been pretty amazing. I mean, I would say that the column ran last Wednesday, and I got emails from people all over the country pretty much every 30 seconds to 60 seconds all day long. I mean, there's so many people that have lost a parent. It's just remarkable.
Now,
and all of them had similar feelings about, you know, what the loss meant to them.
And what age group are you talking about that you heard back from?
Oh, you know, what struck me, and my daughter later helped me answer, hundreds of the emails, the different ways that people can lose their parents. I heard from people who lost their parents to suicide, to murder, to accidents, to disease, you know, diseases like cancer where it's, you know, they have a while to say goodbye, and diseases like, and then heart attacks where it just, they never said goodbye. And so I just had a sense of all the ways a child can lose a parent.
I know that you're traveling, Jeffrey, and I so appreciate your calling. I must say I thoroughly took in the last lecture with Randy Pausch. I thought it was an absolutely beautiful book. Congratulations.
Well, thanks. And, you know, I should just say one thing that Randy said before he died. You know, he wanted his kids to know that he had memories of them. It wasn't just that they would remember him or not remember him. So he wrote down the things he remembered about each of them, the way they laughed, the way they smiled, and those things are things that they're going to hold on to.
I want to tell our listeners that there's a link on our website to Jeffrey Zaslow's piece, Families with a Missing Piece. Thanks for joining us, Jeffrey.
Thank you. Thanks for having me on.
All right. And let's go now to Falmouth, Massachusetts. Good morning, Maura. You're on the air.
Oh, good morning, Diane. Thank you so much for taking my call.
Surely.
I just wanted to ask a question, but first to preface that I lost my father when I was 7 in an air accident. He was in the Navy, and he left, and leaving my mother, age 36, with 6 kids, ages 2 through 10.
Wow.
So that was, you know, like, whoa, you know. And I felt that at the time that God was punishing me because I wasn't being good enough. And when I was older and I told people that, they would say, oh, you're silly to think that. But when you're 7 years old, your life experiences are rather limited.
Yeah.
So, you know, you think that. And so I tried to be perfect, which carried me over into my adulthood. And so my question, you know, so those are all those other issues. But my question is, what about the age when a child loses a parent? Because I was 7, so my parents were like God, and they were my universe. And how is it different when a child is 7 as opposed when a child is 10 or 12?
Mary.
I think there is a lot of difference. Lynn talked a little bit about it beforehand. Young children have magical thinking. Young children aren't grounded in reality. And so there's all sorts of ways they can think about things that are not realistic in adult terms. And so the sense that they're responsible for the person's death, or that somehow if they're good, the person will come back, or that the idea that somehow someone can make a difference, can change reality. As kids get older, they get more concrete. They begin to recognize that dead is dead, that gone is gone, and the person isn't coming back. And that so often, then in those years, the 9, 10, 11, 12 years, we see a lot of anger sometimes because they know that life is unfair. It's the unfairness that so often kids 9 to 12 feel, that it's not just. And so there is a difference.
Thanks
in age
for
groups.
Calling, Mar. Any comment, Lynn?
I just wanted to add that they feel like they were ripped off, and they were ripped off. It wasn't fair. It's not supposed to happen as a kid. Your parents are supposed to be like superheroes
forever.
And then they don't get that validated. That feeling that they did get ripped off. I mean, they just don't hear that from anybody. So that adds to that frustration and anger.
Holly.
And our study also confirms that children and adolescents were at greater risk than those who were young adults at the time of parental death.
Greater risk for?
For the outcomes we studied.
For depression and anxiety.
All right. Here's a message on Facebook from Darcy, who says, my daughters were 10 and 6 when I had to tell them upon waking up that their father had died during the night without warning. I worried from that moment on what kind of impact that would have. I had a strong church community which adopted my children, and that must be a huge help, Mary.
Yes, I think that so often, even if a family hasn't thought very much about their spirituality, one of the things that death does is it brings out the aspects of spirituality. What does the family really believe? What is there a God or not? And so I think that it's a time when the whole family sometimes re-looks at or begins to understand more fully what their religious practices are, what their spiritual beliefs are, then, and whether that carries the family through and supports them, or whether in some ways it feels like a loss, that there isn't enough support.
Lynn.
And it's a really common thing for the parents to want to take away that hurt in their children. And there's, unfortunately, no way they can. It's like a huge hole inside of you after a loss. And the parents fill in that one piece as best they can. But the thing is to find things and people, whatever resources, whether it's church or relatives or support groups or camps or counseling, but to fill that hole with things and people to get outside resources.
And I'd also like to say that for those who lose a family member to suicide, it's especially challenging, I think, because of the stigma associated with that condition. And so the isolation may be more of an issue.
And especially if there are religious connotations about suicide, that it's a sin or that it's wrong.
What do you hear from people about, if I could only have one more day, or if I could only have one more hour with my parents? You must hear that a lot.
We hear it so often, and so many times is I would tell them how much I appreciated them. I would be able to express my gratitude. One of the biggest regrets that that people have when they've lost a parent early is that they didn't have a chance to express gratitude, and especially at a time when you're not feeling so grateful for your parents. You're a teenager, and you think they're a real pain, and they don't understand. And so, looking back on it, so often adults looking back on it say, I so wish I'd been able to express my gratitude, because now I understand what they were about.
To Richmond, Indiana. Good morning, Sarah. You're on the air.
Hello. I am 23 years old, and my father passed away of cancer when I was 21, but I had a sister at the time who was 19, and I was just wondering, do you find that people have a harder time as only children going through the loss rather than if they have help from siblings?
I think that it just depends on who their support system is. What happens after the loss is almost as impactful as the death itself. So depending on whether they're only children or they have siblings, I had siblings, but it didn't mean we supported each other. If anything, we just kept acting like it didn't happen and our relationship stayed the same. But it depends on who steps in, who can they talk to. Who
did you and your brothers talk about it at all?
Not really.
And I think
it was because everything else had changed, and the fact that we kept treating each other was the same was some sort of comfort, that we didn't become extra nice or nurture, it just stayed the same was somehow comforting. I do remember one time my brother Matt and I walked home, and there was a strange car in the driveway, and we stopped at the same time, and I said, oh my gosh, why is that car here? Every time I see a strange car in the driveway, I worry somebody has died. Huh. And he said, me too. So it was right there, but we didn't reach out and comfort each other.
Yeah, interesting. So it really depends on the circumstance. To Bruce here in Washington, D.C., good morning. You're on the air. Bruce, are you there?
Yes, I am here. I'm a psychoanalyst and psychiatrist who has worked with Mary at the at the Wendt Center. In response to research studies, we did a school-based mourning project in the D.C. Public schools with some very innovative group techniques to reach elementary school children, based on the premise that there's a great deal of underlying depression that, if it is not worked with, leads to inhibition in learning and to often with children and adolescents, aggressive acting out. And we had some very positive results.
Mary, can you talk about
that? Yes. Good morning, Bruce. I think that that's one of the things that we realized, that we could reach so many more children on a school-based process, and being able to get school counselors and other people in the school be more aware of what children need, and it's not just depression, but also the anxiety that goes with a loss.
Well, and the anxiety you felt seeing that strange car in your driveway, that must be have been right there.
Yeah, and I think that after you experience the loss and you know it can happen to you, your safety net is ruined as a child, so you're always kind of waiting for the other shoe to drop.
All right, to Mayfield, Kentucky. Good morning, Barbara. You're on the air.
Good morning, Diane. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
Listening to your discussion on grief and children, I just wanted to share my experience. When I was around 14, our family lost my youngest brother, who was 9, to a terrible farming accident.
Ugh.
And it was just horrible. And the whole family, we all went through the shoulda, coulda, wouldas, like you guys were talking about.
Yeah.
My mom just shut down. And all of us, we just had to grieve kind of alone, quietly. And mom just wasn't there for us. And so as I grew up, mother and I were very distant, and I had a lot of negative feelings because I felt she just wasn't there for me. And then about 4 years ago, she was had a terminal illness, and I ended up being her caregiver.
Hmm.
And we grew a lot closer. We worked out some things, but I actually, you know, it was like I ended up being the parent, and during her illness, and her death was devastating for me. It was like I relived two deaths instead of one.
Oh, Barbara, I'm so sorry for both the loss of your brother and your mother. Not unusual for a parent to somehow go very quiet and grieve internally, perhaps, without letting that child, that other living child, in.
Yes, I think that that's what we were talking about before, that even the best of parents, when they are experiencing grief, they are in their own process of devastation, and that they don't do it on a conscious level. It's they just can't deal with the overwhelming feelings. And so often it's because other people in their community are not really supporting them fully.
Mary Owen, the Wendt Center for Loss and Healing, and you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. Let's go finally to New London, Connecticut. Good morning, Patrick. You're on the air.
Good morning, Diane.
Hi.
Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I just had a question, comment. I was wondering what your guess, how they would compare a child losing a parent to death to a child losing in some sense, losing a parent, like an absentee parent or a parent who just isn't there, you know, through drug addiction or alcoholism or whatnot.
Yeah, it's a very different yet similar situation, Lynn.
Well, and it is the difference is with death, it's permanent.
Yeah.
So the relationship, there is no, oh, maybe they'll come back or maybe someday we'll reconnect. It's permanent, and it is grieving the memories that were yet to be made and finding out ways to maintain those connections to them. Whereas if you know they're out there somewhere or there's a divorce or abandonment, you know, it is knowing that they're out there some way and maybe someday. And so it's not as it's not as concrete. It's more gray.
When you have these camps that I gather are how long? 1 week, 2 weeks, what?
We have camps that are weekends and week long.
Week long. And you have professional counselors there. And do they separate the children into groups? Tell me how that works.
That's a unique aspect of our camp, is that we break the kids down by age, and that there's therapists, we call them healing circle leaders, who lead the kids in an hour and a half to 2 hour discussions, telling their story, talking about feelings and emotions, talking about ways to stay connected, giving them tools to carry over outside of camp, because we're not certainly going to cure or fix them. It's a lifelong journey. So to prepare them for those tough days outside of camp. So that's a really important aspect of camp. It's important to have fun and get back to being a kid again, but it's so important for them to get validated that whatever they're thinking or feeling is absolutely okay.
And how do people find those camps online?
ComfortZoneCamp.org, or we also have a new website called HelloGrief.org, which is for grieving teenagers, adults, and people who support them.
And Mary, I know you wanted to comment.
Well, one of the things that we do at camp is have a lot of fun, as well as being able to process very, very deep, strong emotions. And one of the tasks of grief is having a relationship with the person who's died. And that's one of the things that I think is important that kids learn at camp or in therapy is, what kind of relationship? I mean, do I think of my dad and I kind of remember his advice, or whatever it is, that there's still a relationship that goes on with the person who's died.
Mary Owen, she's clinical director of the Wendt Center for Loss and Healing. Holly Wilcox is assistant professor in the Division of Child and Adolescent Psychiatry at Johns Hopkins School of Medicine and Public Health. And Lynn Hughes, she's chief executive officer and founder of Comfort Zone Camp and author of the book, You Are Not Alone. Thank you all for being here. Thanks for listening, all. I'm Diane Rehm.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkard, Nancy Robertson, Jonathan Smith, Susan Neighbors, Denise Couture, and Monique Nazareth.